morning. Hope everybody is well. We are holding in Perek Chaf Aleph. Perek Chaf Aleph of the Netzach Yisrael. Now, this Perek has, I would guess one would say, two basic sections in the discussion. The first is to some degree reminiscent of things that we've discussed before, so we will try to do it on the quicker side. The second is a subject, so to speak, what you might call the moment we've been waiting for, which is, this is really the point in the Sefer Netzach Yisrael about the Golios, where the Maral deals with Yishmael, the non-Golos, or the un-Golos. Right, the with Yishmael, and how Yishmael fits into this picture here. Yishmael, which looms so large in our eyes and in our present tense and our current experience, and how that how those two connect to each other, and that's more of the, I guess completely untouched ground in terms of the Netzach Yisrael here, and we're going to spend more of our time today on that. On that part of this section. Okay. So, he's been dealing with the ideas of Olam Hazeh, Olam Haba, the status, there's a spot right here, the status of the Bnei Yisrael in this world versus the status of the other nations, and how it's to be addressed and reconciled. And he said, HaKadosh Baruch Hu creates, what he speaks about here, the first theme which he discusses is the Malchios represent this strength in Olam Hazeh, the strength in this world, whereas Klal Yisrael represents the strength in the world to come. And in this world, when we speak about the material, the physical world, we speak about the Ktzavos, the edges, the Arba Kanfes Ha'aretz, the four corners of the earth. This world was created with a Hay, right? As we've discussed many times, the Hay is the Dalid, right? Which is the four, and the number four, and also positioned as having two planes, two dimensions with four ends, with four extremes. And that's what the four kingdoms that rule over the Bnei Yisrael at different times during this world, during life in this world, that's what that represents. It represents the times when the spiritual does not dominate within this world. But at the same time, there also has to be a place for Yisrael in this world, because being that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is the one who created the physical world. So besides the physical things which exist, besides these four malchios and these other dimensions which will exist, of course the spiritual has to exist as well. And therefore we find also not just the existence of Klal Yisrael, but the strength of Klal Yisrael to the extent and at the times that it is going to be able to be revealed. And he more extensively discusses this idea that Klal Yisrael is the Nekuda Be'emtza, it's that point in the middle, if you would have it, the little regal, the little leg of the hay, the little point of the hay within the Dalid, that's the position of Klal Yisrael, that's the Malchus HaKadusha that would necessarily exist. And he speaks more about this idea. The segue into what we're going to, now he brings in other stuff, but the segue into what we're going to discuss is to really read here two Gemaras that speak about the Umay Sa'ilam. One Gemara is the famous Gemara in the beginning of Maseches Avodah Zarah, which speaks about the end of days, where HaKadosh Baruch Hu will bring the Sefer Torah, hold it in his lap, and say anyone who is involved in this should come and take the reward. Come and get the rewards of the Torah. So, what happens is the Gemara describes really how all the nations of the world come, jump up and want to rush forward to get their reward. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, hold on, let's do this one at a time. And it starts out with the Romans, and the Romans come and make their case, which is dismissed. And then the Persians, Malchus Paras, the Persians come afterwards, and they make their case. And they also get rejected. Both of them basically argue, as we discussed a couple of weeks ago, They said, oh, everything which we built all of these different things. The Romans had one set of things that they created. The Persians had another set of things that they created. And they all said they did it for the Jewish people to be involved in Torah. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu laughs at them. And he says, you know, come on, fools, you did it for yourselves. And we talked about, again, we talked about this notion last time. However, they leave, and they leave disappointed. HaKadosh Baruch Hu turns this away. So so the same happens, however, to all the other umays, to all the other nations, right? Miyad yotzim ulfonim pachi nefesh, and then the other nations come in, and they figure they'll try, but it doesn't work. So the Gemara says, I'm not reading more correctly. Let's go back one step. Hold on. The Gemara asks, if the Romans went in and failed, why did the Persians think that they could go in and be successful? Says the Gemara, because they figured the Romans destroyed the Beis HaMikdash. So that's why maybe Hashem threw them out. But we, the Persians, we built the Beis HaMikdash. The second Beis HaMikdash was built under Koresh, right? And Daryovesh, right? These were kings of Paras and Madai, and therefore they preside over the building of the Beis HaMikdash, so they figured they had an advantage. However, it didn't work for them. V'chein l'chol uma v'uma. And so, for every other nation, says the Gemara, if they saw the earlier ones didn't help, why did they think so? They said, well, these Malchios at least were involved in subordinating the Jewish people. Even the Persian Empire subordinated the Jewish people. We didn't do so. Says the Gemara, Ma'ishna hani dechashivi, ma'ishna hani delei chashivi lehu. Says the Gemara, okay. So they all, perhaps, might have gone in. But why were these ones mentioned and the other ones not mentioned? Because these, their kingdom will extend until the Mashiach comes. Okay, so that's what the Gemara says, that Persia and Rome, their kingdoms will continue to some degree until the time of Bias HaMashiach. Now, the Tosfos already asks from a Gemara, which is found in two places. Found in Sanhedrin, the note which is given in the Gemara, in the, you know, by the note takers in the Tosfos in Sanhedrin, is the Gemara in Sanhedrin, but the primary place of it seems to be the Gemara in Yuma, which this Gemara right here. could you pass me the Yuma from the large house there?
The disappearing ink?
Thank you. Thank you very much. The Gemara says as follows. Amar Rebbe. Rebbe said, Asida Romi Shatipo Biyad Paras. Rome will fall before Persia. Shenemar, as it says, L'chein Shimu Atat Hashem Asher Yoat Al Edoim Machshuvesav Asher Choshav Al Yishvei Teimon Im Lo Yischavum Tzirei Atzon Im Lo Yosim Aleim Noham. So we say that the this pasuk is referring to Edom and saying to them that the Tzirei Atzon, the small ones of the sheep, so to speak, will destroy them, will take them apart. And we understand that to be a reference to Paras. Says the Gemara, my mashma, Amar Maskev L'Rabba Elu, my mashma, I tira atzon parasu. Where do you get that tira atzon, the young ones of the sheep, refers to Paras, the sieve, as it says, O'ayla sharisa bala karnayim, malche madayu paras. It brings a pasuk, but maybe it's Yavon, which also is referred to. Says the Gemara, Amar Le, the whole story, man liyada pushe kroy maisif tiufta l'rabbi, my tira atzon zutra da'achui. Right, it says, the one who doesn't understand how to read psukim asks this question. Tira atzoin, the smallest of the sheep, refers to the smallest of his brothers, the Tani Rav Yosef, tiras zeporas. Right, it describes the children, right, the descendants there of Noach, and it says, meshech v'siras, siras is the youngest, that refers to poras. So that's what he says. Rav Bar Bar Chana, however, says, asid ha-raymi shetipo liyad poras, kal v'chaymer, Romi will fall in the hands of Persia as a Kal V'chaimer. If the first Beis HaMikdash, which was built by the Bnei Yisrael, by the Bnei Shem, Hechrivu Kasdiim, and the Babylonians destroyed it, but the Babylonians, rather the Babylonians who were able to destroy the first Beis HaMikdash, which was so strong, fell ultimately in the hands of the Persian Empire, Mikdash Sheni, the second Beis HaMikdash, that the Persians built, and that the Romans destroyed, how much more so that the Persians will be able to destroy the Romans. Very interesting kind of a Kal V'chaimer. Okay, so that's what he says. That's one opinion. Then Rav says, Asida parashatipo biadlaim. No, it's going to be the other way around. The Persians will fall in the hands of the Romans. That's the idea. And Rav Kana and Rav Asi said to Rav, how could it be? Benuye biad sesure. Doesn't seem right. When you say the Romans will fall before the Persians, that's nice. The Persians built the Beis HaMikdash and the Romans destroyed it. So it's nice for the Persians to be on top. But here you're saying the other way around, that the Romans will defeat the Persians. The destroyers will destroy the builders. Amar Lui says, in Xeris Melechi, that's Xera of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. A different version has it, Inunami HaKosasri BeKnishta. They also have destroyed plenty of Bote Knesios, plenty of other places of Kedusha, the smaller place of Kedusha. Plenty of those were destroyed by the Romans. And the Gemara continues with a little bit more of the same thing. And the Rav Yudam Rav said, Ein ben David bo'at she'tifshet malchus Rome yersha b'chol eilam kulei tisha chadashim. Mashiach will only come when Rome extends its dominion over the world for 9 months. Okay, now this Gemara would be, if one who understands the Malchus Paras, what do we call Malchus Paras today?
Iran.
Right? Now, given the preoccupation of the world today, of foreign policy, of American foreign policy, and the world, in a great extent, foreign policy, to the extent certainly that it's influenced by America, and that the one would say that today the clash of the superpowers is no longer seen as the clash between America and the Soviet Union, but instead it's seen as America and the would-be superpower, the saber-rattling power of the Iranians. So this Gemara certainly has a great strength. Who's going to win? One opinion in the Gemara says that Malchus Raimi, right, which we usually identify with the Western world, with the Christian empires, with America at this point in time, will triumph over the Persians. And the other opinion says, no, the Persians will triumph over Malchus Raimi. Okay? There's no halacha over here. There's no halachic ruling that comes out in this Gemara. But the Gemara in that sense is certainly very poignant. Now, before we get to the world of Yishmael and its relationship to this, certainly its relationship to Malchus Paras, which is very, very interesting and complex, they're not the same. You know, today, if you read the story, so very, very simply in the world, they will always say that there are so many Muslim countries, but there are so many Arab countries. And the Persians, Iran, is not an Arab country. It's a Muslim country, but it's not an Arab country. Right? So would we equate it with Yishmael? We may not at all equate it with Yishmael. We may say it's something different. But it's Paras. It's Malchus Paras. So let's see a little bit more. And this is significant stuff, and we always are not able to apply the principles with confidence to current events, lacking prophecy, right, and the ability to see things in that kind of a way. However, it certainly provides us with a lot of food for thought in terms of how we are to look at the things around us. But the Maharal is not yet getting to Yishmael. He speaks about these two kingdoms, Paras and Edom, that really indeed have a role until the coming of Mashiach. Paras and Edom, which one's going to be higher, right? These both of them, the Gemara says, the language of the Gemara in Avodah Zarah is that both kingdoms extend till the coming of Mashiach. So when Taisus asks, what do you mean? The Gemara says that Rome will fall in the hands of Persia, or Persia will fall in the hands of Rome. That means only one of them is going to be left standing. So he says, yeah, it means pretty much right up until the coming of Mashiach, both of them will be powers. Says the Maharal that, in a sense, when we speak about the four Malchios, of the physical world, the four to a certain degree reduce to two. And Paras and Edaim represent, one will represent the right side, one will represent the left side. Right? In both planes, you're going to have these two extremes. So the four reduces to two. And to some degree, that's what these two kingdoms will represent. These two Malchios represent the continuation of all of the Malchus, of everybody else. They are the Chashivi, they are the significant ones. They are the representative ones. Now, I do want to mention to you now, to move in, again, he speaks about some other things, and let's actually just do one other thing which he darshans. He says, there's a medrash from Zechariah, which says, Pishnayim yikaresu vashlishis yivaser bah. Two, the Pishnayim, the double portion will be cut out, but the third will remain. So what do we say? Pishnayim refers to, according to the drasha, these Malchios, these two kingdoms, Paras and Edom, the two kingdoms which remain, those that are split on extremes. Klal Yisrael, however, is called the Shlishi. The Medrash says they're called the Shlishi because they are the children of the three Avos. You remember from the Agadah of Shabbos, and we talked about it a long while ago in the Netzach Yisrael, is that Rav Yosef said that blessed is HaKadosh Baruch Hu who gave the triple Torah, Torah Nevi'im Uksuvim, to the Amat Lisa, to the triple people, Kehanim Levim Yisraelim, B'Yarchat Lisa, and the third month, Nisan Yar Sivan. Right, there's this notion of Klal Yisrael as the third, and the third in the Maral is always, instead of these two extremes, the Emtza, the middle, the blend of them. So here you have it. These are these two, which is the reduction of the four. They get cut away because they're on the extremes and they drop off of the edges. But the Shlishi, Klal Yisrael, that's the third, they emerge with their magnificence. So this is sort of familiar kinds of Maralian numerology in order to explain how these things work. Okay. But now, the Maral moves on to say, okay, but let's now say, what's going on here with Malchus Yishmael? Where does Yishmael fit in to the picture? How are we to understand Yishmael's role? Yishmael is significant. And he says, Ki chaya gedela ma'od. People say, it's such a big chaya, such a big one of the animals. In other words, all of the Malchios appeared as animals in the dreams of Daniel. And he says, you know, they have this tremendous potency, this tremendous significance. So what is the role of Yishmael that somehow it doesn't figure into all of this? Why does Yishmael not figure into all of this? Remember, as well, in the times of the Rishonim, right, they were dealing contemporaneously with the Muslim conquest, with the Crusades, the Christians versus the Muslims. These were times, you know, the Muslims had great power and great control. Where, if so, does Malchus Yishmael fit into the picture? So the Maral has two approaches. We're going to learn the Maral's two approaches. We're going to look, Amir Tashem, a little bit at some other approaches that exist. We'll look at a Ramban. We'll share a little bit something very interesting from Rav Huttner. But I'm going to start with the second approach of the Maral, which the Maral considers in a certain sense to be Ikar, to be main, the main approach. But it's, and in certain ways it has very, very strong echoes. There's less for us, in a sense, to parse and to analyze about it than the first approach. And this approach is a fascinating one, which is that Poras equals Yishmael. That the koach, Maral says, you know, each nation has its koach, has its strength. Each malchus represents a koach of strength. Poras does not equal Yishmael by DNA, by genealogy. It's two different things. Right? Poras is from the, right, you look in Parshas Noach, right, when it describes the the kingdoms, the families that emerge from the thing, so Bnei Yefes were Gomer, Umagog, Umadai, the Yavan, the Suvol, Umeshech, the Siros. And Siros, the Gemara, identifies with Poras. And that means that they were one of the Bnei Yefes. That's who they were. Yishmael, of course, is a descendant of Avram Avinu, from the Bnei Shem. They're not genealogically the same. However, the koach that was represented by Malchus Paras, the Maral views as the same as the koach of Malchus Yishmael, and that it views its qualities as being the same. Paras is described as very agitated and very gluttonous, right? The Paras is compared to the bear, right? So the Gemara says the bear is eichlim v'shaisim, right? They eat and drink like a bear, and they're surrounded with flab like a bear, and they don't rest like a bear, right? You ever go to the zoo, you see the bear's always pacing back and forth and back and forth. You know, they sleep for 6 months a year, whatever it is, but they, when they're awake, ein lahem menucha, they're agitated. And so he says that in Hanhaga, the heir to Malchus Paras is Malchus Yishmael. Now that is a fascinating thing when you think about this, about contemporary issues. Because again, nowadays you'll ask the average person who's not going to read up on this thing, and they'll equate the Persian Empire today, the Iranians, with the Arabs. Right? And Lamaisa, they certainly are by and large worshipping the same faith. These are Sunnis and these are Shiites and these are Wahhabis and who knows what, you know, but bottom line is the same framework of faith exists amongst them all. And here we are with this clash of the titans, right, which Christianity and Islam certainly have been the titans for the past 1,000 years, right, the two of them. And while the Persian Empire has certainly had its downs for much of the time, but it has also, you know, shown itself to be a very, very potent force. Certainly nowadays, it's the obsession of the world, and for very, very understandable reasons, Malchus Paras. And certainly, the Islamic world is a very, very significant force that we are all reckoning with, and how they are blending together, and, you know, Europe, Christian Europe, and Muslims, and everything else. So putting these together has significant echoes in the Gemara, but we don't have a tremendous amount of analysis of things here. Now you could say, just again to add, and I say this all, please understand, I say this all very much speculatively. Very speculatively. But if you, right, nowadays people will give you pictures of Yerushalayim, right? And the pictures of Yerushalayim will be dominated by Golden Dome, right? And we can't take it. We in our, we return them. You know, those things. You know, it shouldn't show it. It shouldn't show it. But Lamaisa, you know, it's there. It's there. And there's an echo there of Inu Sasri Vanan Baninan. Right? The Romans destroyed the Makom HaMikdash, and the Muslims, Malchus Paras, built up the Makom HaMikdash. Now, when the Gemara is saying it, it's not talking about building it up l'shem Islam, l'shem Muhammad, but it is talking about the fact that they built the second Beis HaMikdash, literally. However, you sense something of it there. I always like to repeat this Marsha, which is a haunting Marsha, and the Marsha makes no mention of things. One wonders whether the Marsha was aware of what was existing in Eretz Yisrael at the time when he wrote it. But the Marsha writes on the famous Gemara of Rabbi Akiva and the Chachamim who observed the Mokom HaMikdash, and they were all crying, and Rabbi Akiva was laughing, because, and the situation was that they saw a fox coming out of the Kodesh HaKadoshim. So everybody knows the Gemara and the end of Makkos, everybody knows the story, whatever, they're crying. It's a place where even a non-Kayan Gadol can go, and here foxes are walking on it, so how could we not cry? And he said, look, this is the beginning of the Geula. This is the, we see this was part of the curse. So the Marsha makes a comment. And how it fits into the flow of the story of the Gemara is not so much for our discussion. What Marsha says is that there was something in what Rabbi Akiva saw that made him pleased. And that was that the Jewish people had not been replaced on the Temple Mount, on the Har HaBayis. That it was empty. That there was a fox, wild animals roving around there. Had he seen that Klal Yisrael was replaced by the Romans, that the Church of the Holy Sepulchre was located on the Har HaBayis, they would have been a lot more upset. The Romans took over for the B'nai Yisrael. But as he saw that it was empty, so as we know, as we read in the Teichacha and Parshas Bechukaisai, the idea that the land will be desolate before your enemies, that no nation is really able to replace Klal Yisrael and Eretz Yisrael and cultivate it and develop it. Eretz Yisrael doesn't respond to others the same way that it does. So to see the Mokam HaMikdash empty was something of a consolation. It meant that it would be sitting there in a certain sense and waiting for the Jewish people. So this Marsha is fascinating. And it's also very troubling when you consider the fact that today, on the right Friday, or the wrong Friday, you can see, you know, tens of thousands of people going there to worship on the Har HaBayis. And, you know, the Shualim Hilchubo, the foxes that walk on it, are now not just literal foxes, right? They're these people who have stolen away from us. So Marsha maybe wasn't aware, the Golden Dome was already built when the Marsha wrote his commentary. Maybe wasn't aware of the fact that Har HaBayis had structures on it. Already at that point, that was a different part of the world. But in any case, there's echoes here of this Gemara that the Romans destroyed and the Persians built. When you equate Yishmael and this rise of Islam with Poras, they built. They destroyed many Batei Knesios. They destroyed many shuls. Right, there's a list of the, I don't know, 50 shuls that were in the old city of Yerushalayim that were destroyed by the Jordanians, right, when they came in and they were given Yerushalayim. They destroy the shuls wherever they can get their hands on them, in recent history, in Gaza and everything else, right, they do that. But the Mokam HaMikdash, they consecrated it, they made it into a central spot, they're very possessive about it, right? Inhu Sasri Vanan Banina. Difference between the Romans and the Persians. Persians built up that spot. Malchus Paras, Malchus Yishmael. It's a certain opposite thing. And of course, that has echoes of the fact that Yishmael has this, what we call this spirituality of its own. Its name is Hashem will hear their calls. Now, yes, Yishmael's spirituality is very different than his brother Yitzchak's Avoda. Yitzchak is the pillar of Avoda, of prayer, of worship. Yishmael is his brother, right? And it's two different forms, two different types of Avodah, beyond the scope of our discussion right now, the differences between them. But Yishmael has this spirituality. Esav, on the other hand, is considered to be a kaifer. Esav is considered to be a heretic, right? You know, completely. Less din, less dayan. There's no judge, and there's no judgment. There's no truth in the world. Right? So why Edom becomes the forerunner of Christianity, right? We probed that a tiny bit the other week, I think, together. Where was that? In this year, right? So we probed that a little bit. But however that is, Yishmael certainly seems to have a more connected spirituality than Edom does. Edom destroys the Beis HaMikdash. Poras / Yishmael rebuilds it. So which one is going to win in the end? Right, that's the debate that you have in that Gemara in Yuma. Will Paras triumph over Edom, or Edom triumph over Paras? But they both figure. They both figure here in the end. There's a fascinating comment from the Gra. The Gra points out, in Parshas Pinchas, we read the Korbanos of Sukkos, of the Yontif of Sukkos. And as you know, on Sukkos we have 70 Purim. 70 bullocks that are offered for the Umay So Island, for the nations of the world, versus the one of Shmini Atzeres that are offered for Klal Yisrael. So the Goyim makes the following cheshbon, the following calculation. On the first day, it says, Usir izim echad chatos, and one sir izim as a chatos. Right? The first day had 13. Okay, I need somebody is going to take on here the charge of counting the Seir Izim ones, okay? And somebody's going to take on the charge of counting the Seir ones, okay? Trust me. Okay, so the first day is Seir Izim Echad Chatos. The first day had 13. Who's taking the Seir Izim? You want to take the Seir Izim? Okay, 13. The second day has again Seir Izim Echad. The second day had 12. Okay, you got it? 25. The third day is Seir, Michael? 11. Okay, just says Seir Chatos. That has 11. The fourth day, it says Sirizim. That's 10. Okay? You already got? 35. The fifth day is Seir Chatos. The sixth day is Seir Chatos. The seventh day is Seir Chatos. Right? The fifth day is 9. The sixth day is 8. And the seventh day is 7. Well, how much do you have? You also have 35. You have 11, 9, 8, and 7 is also 35. 35 to 35. 35 in the Sirizim category, 35 in the Seir category. So the Goyin says, Vatzfir Vatzair, it's beyond the scope of our discussion, but he says, the Sirizim versus the Seir, I think Sirizim is Yishmael, and Seir, plain, is Seir, is Esav. Each one, Esav and Yishmael, correspond to the Shivim Umos. They are the 70 nations. Each one is 35. Each one has half of the world in its corner. You know, remember the Maharal's reductionism that we had before? There are four kingdoms that rule over the world. They really reduce to two. Those two are Paras and Edrei. Those four kingdoms are representative of the 70 nations of the world. And those 70 nations also reduce down to two. Who are those two? Esav and Yishmael. Esav is Edom. According to the Maral, Yishmael is Paras. Right? So the Gemara speaks about Paras and Yishmael and Edom. We do. When the Pasuk speaks about Hashem offering the Torah to the nations of the world, right? Everybody knows He went to all of the nations of the world, right? But on the other hand, the Pasuk, the remez to it in the Pasuk in V'zayis HaBracha is, right? Hofia, right? Hashem Yisinai Bo V'zarach Miseir Lomo. Seir is Esav. Hofia Me'ar Paran is referring to Yishmael. The only two that it refers to is Esav and Yishmael explicitly in the Pasuk. The Chazal tell us famously, went to Esav, said Lo Sirtzach, went to Yishmael, said either Lo Signav or Lo Sinav, whatever it was. They are the representatives, to some degree, of those powers in the world, of the two powers that exist in the world. And whether it's those two major Yitzrei Hara, right, one of them being Ritzicha, and one of them being Arias, right, Kina and Taiva, whatever it is, right, again, when you figure the twos, the threes, the various things, we can't go everywhere. But you understand, to some degree, that that's what's there. And it's not the pshat, therefore, that the world, okay, now we're finished with the first 35, and all we're left with is the last 35. Esav, right, this Malchus Edom, this is the final curtain call over here. This is the last hurrah. And to some degree, that includes all of the nations. So it includes Paras, and it includes Edom, includes Yishmael, and includes Edom. And of course, as we know, as we say in the Slichas, Kalei Seir v'chaisnai v'alu l'tzion v'yishiyim. What does that mean? Rabban Hashem destroys Seir and his father-in-law, and let the Moshiim go up to Har Tzion. Who was the father-in-law of Esav from his third marriage? Was Yishmael. Esav, after Yaakov was sent to go and marry from the family of Avram, went and married Achais Nevoyas. Right, he married the daughter of Yishmael. So we say, destroy Seir v'chaisnai. We understand Esav and Yishmael are there till the end. Paras and Yishmael are there till the end. So this blending of the Persian Empire with this is very, very significant. Okay. So that's the Maral, what the Maral considers to be Ikar.
The 70 nations, the number 70 comes from the listing in Parshas Noach.
Parshas Noach, yes.
Which doesn't include Edom,
doesn't include
or
either one.
Yishma.
Doesn't include either one. But then, from the Zera Avram, from the seed of Avram, the ones that get cast away, Yishmael and Esav, they represent, you know, the concentrated form of those two great of the rest of the world. Now, even within the Zera Avram, there are those who stay, and there are those who are going to be gone. Okay, so that's what he considers to be the Ikar approach. It diverts to some degree the attention from Yishmael and everything we biblically know about Yishmael, and all we're left with is the little we biblically know about Paras. Right, we know about Paras from Nevi'im, Uksuvim, and
And as such, we have something. We have this notion that they built the Beis Hamikdash, that they somehow have access to this sort of the pseudo spirituality. However, we have a lot more information about Yishmael than we do about Paras, in terms of stuff to work from, it would seem. So let's now go to the other approach of the Maharal, and to the approach of the others, where they look a little bit more closely at Yishmael and why Yishmael doesn't really have a malchus of his own. And I don't think that we have to view this pshat as being completely disconnected from the second pshat of the Maharal, which puts together Yishmael and Paras. You know, there can still be a relationship between them in terms of certain qualities which exist. Okay. What's the other approach of the Maharal? The Maharal says like this, that Yishmael doesn't get counted amongst the Arba Malchiyos because Yishmael did not take the Malchus from Yisrael. Okay, if you have the Hartman edition, I'm on page Tafnun Aleph, the bottom of the first column. What people say and claim that Yishmael is so significant, that's not a problem. Why, even though they're so significant, they don't get counted amongst the Arba Malchios. It speaks about the four kingdoms that take the Malchus of the Holy High Ones. Four kingdoms will arise and will take the Malchus of the Kedoshim Elyonim and will inherit that Malchus for all eternity. In the classic edition, it's on page Kufches in the second column. These four kingdoms take the Malchus of Kedusha. And the meaning of this is, Kasher Kadishin al Yainim Ayelam Amalchus, Oisei Malchus Atzmai Moser Hashem Yisbarach Ledal Malchus. The kingdom that belonged to the holy and high ones, Hashem took it from them and gave it to these others. Ki Mikayach Oisei Malchus Amdu Elu Malchus, Ki Notal Malchus Kadishin al Yainim. And so on. Ki Amdu Mikayach Malchus Kadishin al Yainim. Shrei Malchus Bavel, let's look at it, he says. The kingdom of Bavel, Amdu Mikayach Malchus Kadishin al Yainim, Shrei Malchus Bavel Natal Malchus Yisrael. Nebuchadnezzar came along, destroyed the Beis HaMikdash, took the Malchus of the Jewish people. And then what happened was Paras came, and direct hit, Paras took over Malchus Bavel. So whatever Bavel had was given over to Paras. Yorsha Malchus Kadish Nelyonim. So they inherited the Malchus of the Kadish Nelyonim. And then Yavan came and took from Malchus Paras. The Greek Empire eclipsed the Persian Empire, and in doing so took the Beis HaMikdash. And Malchus Edom took it from Yavon, Kasher Yodua. Avol Malchus Yishmael, but the kingdom of Yishmael, Afal Pish Yishmael Heya Tekifa Lechada, even though Yishmael was very strong, in other words, he's using the verse in Daniel which describes the four kingdoms as being very strong, so he says, look, it fits the very strong criterion of Daniel, but Le'omda Mikayach Malchus Kedish Nel Yainim, but it doesn't fit the other criterion. It didn't take the Malchus of Kedusha. Rak Elu Malchus Omda Min Malchus Kedish Nel Yainim. It's as long as they are kings, because they have taken it from us, that we can't have our geula, because we have to get it back from them. It doesn't come to their place. Malchus Yishmael might be strong, but they're not b'chol the alba malchiyos asher kiblu malchus kadishin al yainim. Says the Maharal something with tremendous reverberations. Okay, but let's first hear what he is saying. Says the Maharal that the Malchus of Yishmael is not like these other Malchios, because it's a power that exists in the world, but it's not a power that exists in the world that's derived from the Malchus of Kedusha of Klal Yisrael. Yishmael rises up in its own corner. It does not eclipse Malchus Edom, did not conquer Rome, Now, there would be times in history, I think the caliphate, I'm not an expert in these things, but there were times when it certainly conquered certain corners of Christian civilization. They fought over Eretz Yisrael, right? The period of the Crusades was the war between the Christians and the Muslims over Eretz Yisrael. And in the pathway over certain areas of Europe as well. However, fundamentally, it arises side by side with Malchus Edom. So Malchus Edom is that which took from the Bnei Yisrael. Malchus Yishmael is in its own corner, and it's in its own place. That's what the Maharal says. So Geula can only come with the restoration of Malchus to the Jewish people. How do the Jewish people get the Malchus? They have to get the Malchus back from the one that took it away from them. Edom is the one that has it now from that which took it away from us. So we have to trounce Edom in order to have the Geula. Yishmael is a sideshow. Yishmael is a sideshow. Now why do I say that has tremendous reverberations? Because the implication is that Yishmael can survive Mashiach. Understand that implication? If Klal Yisrael gets its Malchus by trouncing Edom, getting its Malchus back from Edom, Yishmael is irrelevant as one of the Malchios that get in the way of the Gula because its kingdom is separate.
It's not a criterion.
It's not a criterion. It's not a figure. Klal Yisrael's Malchus is not going to be contingent on Yishmael's. And therefore, Klal Yisrael can get its Malchus back. Yishmael could be up. Yishmael could be down. And never the twain shall meet.
How do we decide what means taking over one Malchus taking over another? I mean, so I guess it's clear, it's very clear that Paras took over Babel, that Yavan took over from Paras, that even that Rome took over from Yavan. All that's very clear. It's much less clear, I mean, in terms of historically what happened, that Yishmael hasn't come and taken over from Rome.
Have they come over? I'm not an expert in the history or even in the contemporary. But have they taken over from Rome? Has the Muslim Empire conquered the Christian Empire, or it has emerged as a force billion strong, right? Huge force within the world. But has it accompanied a downfall of the other kingdom? Or has it elbowed for some space on the world stage next to it? The Greek Empire was trounced, was destroyed by the Romans. And the Greeks did the same thing to the Persians, and the Persians did the same thing to the Babylonians. But the Yishmael never trounced or destroyed the Romans.
Why there is a problem with Yishmael that is? Why there would be any problem?
Why would there be any problem? I just was sort of like looking forward to them not existing. You know, to imagine Yishmael with everything that Yishmael means as, you know, still being able to be there. Now, again, the Maharal doesn't speak that out. But there's this implication here that it's irrelevant because its Malchus doesn't make it or break it. You know, it's there. It's there on the side. It's not central to the Malchus of Yisrael.
Doesn't make sense to a certain extent when Abraham sought that bracha for Yishmael that he should also exist. Even though I continue to
Perfect.
Not understand, you know, why and the depth of that, but he had to give it and ask for that bracha.
Okay, good.
Asaph
Excellent.
Asaph receives brachos also. And wouldn't they have
Sorry?
To do Asaph
Asaph
receives brachos also?
Yeah, but I think those are more isolated. I think Asaph brachos are more visible for the to serve Yaakov, whereas Yishmael's brach, I thought, was more open-ended. If I understand it correctly.
Okay, well, there's a little more to it. There's a little bit more to it. More to it than that. But let's look here at one more, even more primary source, which is the Ramban. The Ramban is at the end of Parshas Balak.
The end of Parsha is Balak. Bilam starts prophesizing around to other kingdoms, hints to all kinds of malchios. And the Ramban discusses it, very Choshev Ramban. It's not found in old editions of the Ramban. It's found in the Shavel Ramban and in the newer editions of the Ramban, ones which are more prevalently used right now. Ramban writes as follows. Rav Avram, the Ibn Ezra, nishtabish bazeh v'hichnis bazeh Malchus Yishmael. He made a mistake, and he included Malchus Yishmael. Ki nafal pachtom elav, because he was awfully scared of Malchus Yishmael. He saw them as a looming power, so he figured they must figure in the picture of the kingdoms. V'toan eich leitimne Malchus g'dayla v'atzuma kamaya. Right? This is what the Maral is really referring to. He said, how can you not count Malchus Yishmael? They've got to be in there. This taina is from a lack of knowledge. Ramban says the four kingdoms of Daniel, they are successive kingdoms. Each one triumphs over the preceding one and takes the kingdom away from it. Each one brings bondage and goes to the Jewish people in the days of its kingdom. There'll be these four successive kingdoms that will oppress and affect the Jewish people. And so our history of Golus can be counted by these four kingdoms. But if there will be other kingdoms at the same time, the Pasuk doesn't enumerate them. There could be other, again, sideshows happening at the same time. Daniel didn't see them. He doesn't have to see them to count to the Geula. Because, look, you know, it's like when you count the 10 generations from Adam until Noach. Right? There were tons of other people besides those 10 people that were mentioned over there. It's just that, look, if you want to figure out your chronology of the world, you get these 10 and you got it all straight. So if you want to figure out the chronology of Golus, you get these 4 and you got it straight. There could be other people rattling sabers and throwing grenades and who knows what at the same time. But if you follow the timeline of these 4 Golias, you've got it covered. He says there were always other contemporaneous Malchios. Even in the early times, you think Madai and Yavan, there was nobody else in the world who had anything to do. There was Haidu, there was Kush, there was Rumna, there were the Tartars, the Zulasam, and so on and so forth. So he says it was Romans who sent us into Golus in the days of Vespasian and Titus, not the Ishmaelim. Wherever we are, even when we're under the club of Yishmael, from Hodu to Kush, we're still in Golus Raimi. Ad sheteva zicha v'nigol mimena. U'mi yedev, ulei teva red machuz Yishmael kaidem ha-Mashiach. Maybe Yishmael will be gone before the Mashiach. Aval chay ha-Ravi is hi asher higlisanu. But it was Edom that sent us into Golus, and he brings the Pasuk Daniel, and its Golus will continue until the coming of Mashiach. And that's what he says. That's the picture. Now, the Ramban sounds in many, many ways like the Maral. Very, very similar in many ways to the Maral. The Maral adds this Nakuda, which is not the Maral. Ramban could be seen to a certain degree as more practical. Now, their kingdom will continue until the end of days. Yishmael's there, okay, they're big, they loom. There were others who were big and loomed large, but the chronology, the timeline will be under Edom. Edom will start, Edom will end, and that's when it'll go. And Yishmael may be gone before, or may be gone. The way the Ramban sounds is at the same time. Right? It could be either way. But Yishmael, right now is here. Certainly they're a factor in our lives, but in terms of the vision, which is trying to span the whole thing, we look at it in terms of Edom. The Maral is saying sharper, adding this Nakuda, that the ones that are counted are the ones that took the Malchus of Kedusha. And they have some hold on the Malchus of Kedusha, and Yishmael didn't take ours. They didn't take hours.
Yes. The Ramban also says that Edom will be till the end. I missed that.
Edom will be till the end. Absolutely, yeah.
So my question is the condition that the Jewish people have to take it back from Edom, or that only the Edom will be destroyed and therefore will be able to regain it? the difference between the Nafkamina being that if we take it back from Edom, then it must be true that Edom is able to not necessarily vanquish, but at least conquer Yishmael. It can't be that Yishmael would vanquish Edom, because we wouldn't be able to take it back from them.
Okay. I hear what you're saying.
If the condition is that we have to be able to take it back, but not necessarily vanquish Edom, then Yishmael could vanquish Edom for us.
I hear. Okay. Rambam doesn't mention, right? Rambam doesn't mention. He says Malchus Edom will endure till the end. He doesn't mention over here. He's not speaking over here about this notion of the Gemara Malchus Paras. He certainly makes no hint of Malchus Paras being equated to Malchus Yishmael, right? But he's saying Edom is till the end, and that's the traditional take. Absolutely. You know, the Gemara that says that Paras will conquer Edom for the end is seems to be, by our tradition, a Das Yochid, you know, in the picture. Okay. Rav Yitzchak Huttner, Zichrono Livracha, Rav Yitzchak Huttner in Elul of 1970, Black September, was on a plane that was hijacked to Jordan. The plane was hijacked to Jordan. He was released on Erev Rosh Hashanah. Erev Rosh Hashanah. He was on a plane that was hijacked to Jordan, sat on a runway, you know, for a couple of weeks. You know, the world was completely on edge, and major, major thing. So, Rav Huttner was famous, generally speaking, for his non-contemporary speeches. In other words, Rav Huttner did not speak about current events. Rav Huttner presented the Torah in its distilled, eternal form, and he left it generally to the imagination of the listener to apply to current events. That was a shita, and it remains a shita of the Berliners. There's one exception to this. Was a little bit of a hint, which he gave, not on Rosh Hashanah. There's some hint, perhaps, on Erev Yom Kippur, that he gave afterwards, but on Sukkot, after he was hijacked. And the account which I'm giving over here is from one of the most beautiful pieces of work that I've ever read in my entire life. And I say that honestly. When I read this, Mamish opened up for me. Worlds is a small work, 100 pages, called Zichronos, which is the biography of Rav Huttner, and it was written by his daughter, Rebbetzin David, and that's published in the Sefer HaZichron run by Pachad Yitzchak in the front. So that's something called Zichronos, the biography. It weaves together his letters and his years. It's just a magnificent, magnificent thing. So in here, on page Nun Hei, on page Nun Hei, she just talks about the Ma'ura of the hijacking, and she writes how, as they were there on the plane on a daily basis, various delegations of Arabs would be brought through the plane, you know, to see the hijackers, and as it says, most of those delegations you would be able to see on their face, she writes, the bracha which was given to Yishmael, which was v'hu yiyeh pera adam, he will be a wild man. However, pam avar alav echad mirashei mishlachas loy ter panim shel nasichas. One time, one of these delegation heads came by, and he had a certain royal bearing. And as he passed through the aisle, right, he noticed Rav Huttner, who was not, first of all, he had a certain bearing, Rav Huttner, but it was no secret that there was a great rabbi. There were all kinds of gatherings all over the world, you know, especially for everybody. But the fact that Rav Huttner was on the plane was not an insignificant thing. And when he came upon Rav Huttner, he bowed to him, and he stopped for a few minutes to speak with him. And after he passed, she writes, Rav Hutner said, "Haponim shaloi hibiu prinsichlkeit," right? Which she said in Yiddish, right? This is the only word which is, his face demonstrates a certain princeliness, the princeliness that can be found in Yishmael. You won't find this in Esav. He has the specific face of Yishmael. This was the comment of Rav Hutner. And when we asked him for clarification, he said, regarding Yishmael, it doesn't say Alufehem. By Esav, it says Alufehem. These are the Alufe Esav. Mm-hmm. By Yishmael, it says they were Nesiim. Nesiim is princes. It's usually very translated. We still didn't understand. And he said, no, I'll explain to you sometime. So what happened? So came Sukkos. And Sukkos, he said, is Mamorim. And he spoke about the fact that by Yishmael we find the expression Nesiim L'Umosam. By Esav we find the term Alufim. So he said, Ha'hevdol b'neim istarei al pnei kol tkufeis yomeis eilam. The difference between them expresses itself throughout history. And it serves as the source and the basis for the difference in relationship between Yishmael and the Bnei Yisrael and Esav and the Bnei Yisrael. What's the idea? Because Aluf is Malchus of Leitaga, the Gemara says. It's a kingdom without a crown. Right? Remember we learned a few weeks ago about how Esav has this parliamentary system that limits them dramatically. Right? It's Malchus of Leitaga. It's a kingdom without a crown. Esav has kingdom to a certain degree. Right? Their kingdom struggles always with the kingdom of Yaakov Avinu. However, the kingdom of Esav ends when the crown really belongs to Yaakov. When Yaakov drops the crown, to some degree it goes over to Esav. When Yaakov can reclaim it, Esav falls by the wayside. However, Yishmael has just Nesiim, which is a term of kavod u'gedula, of honor and greatness, but without malchus, without the power of malchus. Yishmael doesn't have a power of malchus at all. This is the difference, he said, between Yishmael and Esav. And here we get to a fundamental point. Esav is a yoresh. Esav was never disinherited by Yitzchak. Remember? In fact, of the 10 nations that were promised to Avram, Esav has Yerusha, Har Seir. We're not allowed to take away Esav's Yerusha until the time of the Mashiach. We're warned against starting wars with Esav over territory. Yerushali Esav Nasati as Har Seir. But regarding Yishmael, Yishmael was disinherited. Goresh as Ha'ama Azois Vespinah Kilo Yirash Ben Ha'ama Azois Yiminim Yitzchak. Of the 10 nations, the 10 lands that were promised to Avram, 7 the Bnei Yisrael got, 1 Esav got, 1 Ammon got, and 1 Moab got. Ammon and Moab are from Lot. Lot was not disinherited by Esav, by Avram. The same words that Avram used with Lot, Yaakov used with Esav. Esav used with Yaakov. There ain't no room for the two of us here, so we'll separate. By Yishmael, it wasn't that there ain't no room. That's what it says, right? The land is not great enough, right, for us to be here together. So therefore, each one has their portion. You'll have it over there. I'll have it over here. But with Yishmael, you would imagine Lot's children inherit. Avram and Yishmael's children don't. Avram Avinu disinherited him. Kilo Yirash ben Amazay Simini Yitzchak. That's what Sarah said. You don't want him to inherit. And Hashem said to Avram, listen to Sarah. So he sent him away. In the Gemara in Sanhedrin, when it speaks about the court cases that the nations leveled in the world court against the Jewish people, it speaks about the Mitzrayim came and they sued, and the Canaan came and they sued the Jewish people. When Yishmael came and sued and said, we are heirs, we get part of Eretz Yisrael. So what did they answer them? They were disinherited. They were sent out of the mix. So they don't have a malchus. They don't have a kingdom. They're in a certain sense a nation without a kingdom, a nation without a country. The Pasuk says, HaKadosh Baruch Hu said to them, they'll live in the desert, right? They'll be para adam. They don't know malchus. They don't know from kingdom. They don't know about Geneva conventions. They don't know about the rules of war.
which is ultimately the notion of malchus. Kingdoms wage war against each other, right? So you get dressed up in your uniform, you represent your kingdom, and you fight. But instead, what do? They get dressed up as pregnant women. They get dressed up as children, right? They fight with non-combatants. This is not a fight of malchios. This is the desert. This is the war of the wild. It's a whole different world. Esav gets a Yerusha. Yishmael doesn't get a Yerusha. And so it says Rav Hutner, it says, Eila alufi adayim l'moish v'esam b'eretz achuz asam. These are the leaders of Esav in their dwelling places, in the land of their holdings. They have a holding. They have a Yerusha. Whereas by Esav it says, Eila shmaisam b'chatzrehem v'tiraisam. These are in their names, in their villages, and their towns. What does that mean? Right? Because, again, they don't have a kingdom. They don't have an achuza. They don't have a place. Esav is a Yerush. Yishmael is not. And therefore, Esav, who has his Yerusha, to some degree, doesn't come and claim. He got his Yerusha. To a certain degree, he can be pacified with his Yerusha. I'll go over there. Yishmael didn't get anything. Shmuel's always frustrated because they know what they have, they never have. They were not given a Yerusha, they were not given a place. And so he says the fury of Yishmael over Eretz Yisrael is the fury of one who has no Yerusha, and therefore he wants to take it away from the one that has the Yerusha. That was what Rav Hutner darshaned, and he darshaned on the heels of this event, and this is what they said. This was as close as he ever got talking about current events. Now, when a person gets hijacked, perhaps it's excusable, right? You know, to say a few words about it, right? But this is it, and this, you know, exactly how this explains, you know, the nesichus, the princeliness of Yishmael, of this one Yishmaeli that he found over there, I don't really understand. To me, that's still not exactly explained. Still not exactly explained. I would say that Yishmael should represent the face of the frustrated. But there is a certain princeliness which the Torah does give to them, as opposed to Esav, which is kingdom without a crown. Again, that part I can't explain to you exactly. It's very juicy. It asks for some explanation, and I don't understand it fully. However, what we have over here is a very, very big part of the picture in what's being discussed. Esav is a malchus. Yishmael is not a malchus. The Torah never refers to them as a malchus. A malchus requires a portion. Arba malchios? Of course Yishmael isn't included in the Arba malchios. Because Yishmael never has a malchus, even for its own, let alone be a malchus to rule over Yisrael. Yishmael is a people without a land, a people without a place. They're not one of the Arba malchios. Esav is a malchus. And Klal Yisrael's kingdom is totally in Esav's. Right? When Yaakov arises, Esav falls. When Esav arises, Yaakov falls. Mashiach can only come when we take it away from Esav. Yishmael is the peanut gallery. Yishmael is the one that's constantly frustrated on the sidelines. Yishmael is not the members of the opposition. Okay? When you're in power, they're the opposition. When they become in power, you suddenly become the opposition. Yishmael's the peanut gallery. Yishmael's there on the sidelines, always watching from the side, never ruling, never controlling, and in a certain sense, therefore, they're the most dangerous. Now, does that mean, therefore, again, Gula will come when Klal Yisrael takes back the kingdom from Esav? What will be with Yishmael? That leaves that perturbing, open-ended thing of the Malchus Kadishin El Yainim. Right, the Malchus, which is that which would belong to the descendants of Avram, Yishmael's not going to get. But they're there. They're still there. And they're still doing stuff. So where does Yishmael fit into the Arba Malchios? Maybe they're poras. Maybe to some degree with their disenchantedness, they'll do that. And therefore maybe we could see that with all of these Arab kingdoms and empires, they don't get any place. But the Iranians, ooh, you know, that's a different story. And all the Arab countries are, in a certain sense, afraid of the Iranians. Yeah, yeah. Right? They know that they're a malchus.
right? They're not. They have more greater ambitions for empires than the Saudi Arabians or whatever else it is. I don't know about Iraq, because that's, you know, they were also Malchus Bavel, you know, they had their own kingdom that they viewed themselves as heir to. So I don't know. At this point, I get very, very hazy, because I can't plug it in. I can't plug it in exactly contemporarily. But I think that there's some meaningful, meaningful food for thought here in terms of the perspective of where Yishmael fits in and where Yishmael doesn't fit in to the scheme of things. Yeah. Sorry for going so long. Yeah.
I'm just curious. I always hear, there might be Persian people here, I don't know, but I've always heard Persian people get very upset if you call them Iranian, they're talking about a non-Jewish Persian people, and they make a very big deal, at least I went to school with like 40% Persian Muslim, they make a very big deal that they're not Arabs, and that they're...
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. But is there Persians, Iranians? Well, what to tell you, well, what's the, how's it perceived?
There's no Arabs. There's no single Arab in that.
No, they're not Arabs. I'm saying Persians versus Iranians. Same thing, yeah.
I'm saying, do they get offended if you say that they're Arabs?
Oh, yeah.
Arabs, yeah. They're not Arabs.
No, but because they make a big deal. The one person I remember gave me a lecture when I was growing up. Because we come from a nation that was a king, basically a kingship.
That's exactly it.
Don't compare us to...
Right. So Yishmael, who's not a kingdom, right, the Maharal makes this equation. The Maharal makes this equation. And on the street, the equation is made... Right? But, you know, now, with this light, in light of this, that's why I said don't get rid of the first one with the second one. Yishmael is the non-Malchus. Paras is the Malchus. Right? The wedding of Yishmael, where in certain senses we see the interests of the Arab world wedded to the interests of the Persian Empire, of the Iranians, right? And in a sense they're lumped together as one big threat. That's this wedding of Yishmael and Malchus Paras that the Maharal spoke about. But they're not the same thing.
They hate each other.
How is it the Iranians then are collaborating so much with so many Arab countries?
What's that?
But the Iranians seem to be...
Right.
Necessarily are, but they're not.
They are, but they're not.
It's a very, very strange. It's a love-hate relationship.
They collaborate because they hate...